Hi guys, welcome to our event tonight. I'm Devin, the VP of Academics for Sigma Iota Rho. We're really excited to be discussing current events in Pakistan here this evening with Dr. Mahia Afzal and Alan Smith, the President of OAS, the Organization of Asian Studies. We're really happy to work tonight with the Cedar Center for Asian Studies and OAS to put on this great event. So, without further ado, I'll introduce our speakers. So how tonight's going to work though, real quick, is that we'll have some brief prepared remarks, followed by a moderated Q&A for about 15 minutes or so. Then you guys have the rest of the time to ask questions that you have. So with that, Dr. Mahia Afzal is the visiting fellow in the Foreign Policy and Global Economy and Development Program at Brookings. Her research lies at the intersection of development, security, and political economy with a focus on Pakistan. She previously worked as an assistant professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, College Park. She is the author of Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society, and State, which you can buy after the event out here for $20 if you would like to. Published by the Brookings Institution Press in 2018. She has also been published in Public Choice and is the author of a USIP special report on education and attitudes in Pakistan. She has written for Pakistani and international publications including Dawn, the Cairo Review, Foreign Policy, the Washington Post, and Newsweek. In addition, she consults various organizations including the World Bank, USAID, DFID, and IFPRI. For her writing on education in Pakistan, she was named to Los Espacio de la Politica's list of top 100 global thinkers of 2013, and she received her PhD in economics from Yale in 2008, specializing in development economics and political economy. So give it up for our speaker.
Hi, everyone. Okay, let's see. Can you hear me? Is this working? Okay. All set? All right. So I have a bit of a cold today, and let me know, and usually I can project far louder than this, but let me know if you can't hear me at the back, all right? What I'm just going to do is talk a little bit about some of the major themes of my book. And then I'm looking forward to discussion with you and then with all of you on events in Pakistan and to answer any questions you might have. So there's a lot going on and I'm sure you've seen a lot in the news recently. So happy to talk about any of that. All right, so my book, as Devin mentioned, Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society, and the State. So this came out last year. So it's been about a year and a couple of months since it's been out. But the themes of the book are very much themes that have been in the news, obviously, for years, and are certainly in the news again now. Even today in the New York Times, there's an article about how the Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has said that, you know, it is time for Pakistan to take action against all militant groups on its soil. So what is Pakistan's relationship with militant groups? What is Pakistan's relationship with extremism? You know, that's sort of the crux of what I explore in this book. So many of you, you know, and many folks in the West sort of think of Pakistan as a state that has sort of come to be defined in terms of its relationship with terrorism and with terror. And it is sort of true that what we see here is either, you know, Pakistanis being killed in terrorist attacks, and it is the case that thousands of Pakistanis, in fact tens of thousands of Pakistanis, died in the time period between about 2007 to 2015 in terrorist attacks. The other sort of picture you see is of Pakistanis who look like sort of irrational fundamentalists. You know, you see images in the media of Pakistanis burning, let's say, an American flag or taking to the streets and attending rallies held by fundamentalists. So it's sort of this one-dimensional picture. And the sort of the perhaps a third kind of image that is seen is, or a notion that one has of Pakistan is of a country that is responsible or is held responsible through militants on its soil or through militants who are associated with the country undertaking attacks in the West, let's say, or in India or in Afghanistan. So all these negative images of the country. What is the real picture? This presents, you know, one side of the story. It presents a very top-down kind of picture of the story, picture of Pakistan, and much of the work on Pakistan, especially in the West, tends to look at it from this sort of top-down security perspective, where sort of regular Pakistanis are conflated with the state itself and sort of characterized as villainous or irrational. So what this book aims to do is look at how Pakistanis think. How do they think about terrorist groups? What do they think about extremism? Are they extremists themselves? What do they think about India? What do they think about Afghanistan? What do they think about the rest of the world, about the United States? And then why is it that they think a certain way? So I'm sorry, I have a bit of a cold, so you'll have to excuse me. And I may be drinking some water during the talk. So the way I do this is I look at public opinion polls in a lot of detail and sort of set out what Pakistanis' views are, then look at narratives. And I did a lot of interviews and focus group discussions in Pakistan in schools, colleges, and universities, and also looked at sort of the prevailing media narratives. So I set out attitudes, and then I set out the roots of the attitudes, and I trace these back to Pakistan's education system, its laws, its politics. So that's what I'll be talking about for the next few minutes. So if you look at what Pakistanis think about violence in the name of Islam, right, against civilians, that presents a very heartening picture, because the vast majority of Pakistanis say, more than 80 some percent, say that they reject violence in the name of religion, okay? Any sort of violence against civilians in the name of religion. If you look at their views on terrorist groups as well, not just on terrorist groups that strike Pakistanis, not just the Pakistan Taliban, which struck, you know, as I said, tens of thousands of Pakistanis, and you know, the Pakistan Army, the Pakistani state, but also groups that strike other countries, so Al-Qaeda, the Afghan Taliban, and Lashkar-e-Taiba. So the Afghan Taliban, you know, strikes mostly targets in Afghanistan. Lashkar-e-Taiba strikes mostly targets in India. And those groups have sanctuary in Pakistan. Even for those groups, Pakistanis, for all those groups, Pakistanis have predominantly negative views towards all of those groups, if you look at the polling data. So that's a hardening picture. But if you start sort of peeling away at narratives on these groups, the picture is much more muddied. So some of the prevailing narratives about the terrorism that hit Pakistan itself between 2007 and 2015, undertaken by the Pakistani Taliban, if you asked a regular Pakistani, as I did, and then, you know, if you saw sort of the narratives in the media, what you saw was that many regular Pakistanis, either blamed the attacks that the Pakistan Taliban undertook and then claimed, saying that they had killed people. They blamed the attacks on India or on the West, on the United States in particular, either in a sort of complete kind of conspiracy theory narrative that, you know, India and the US planned these attacks because they wanted to destabilize Pakistan, or saying that these attacks were a response to US policy. So these attacks are a response to US drone strikes, for instance, people would say. Or they would say that these attacks are a response to Pakistan's alliance with the US in the war on terror. And so the Pakistan Taliban is trying to fight the Pakistani government's alliance with the US in the war on terror. So that was sort of one major narrative, blaming the attacks on India and the West. The second major narrative was that the Pakistan Taliban was undertaking these attacks because it wanted to implement an Islamic system in the country. And that was the Pakistani Taliban's narrative. That was their sort of kind of propaganda that they put out. So, you know, where do these views come from? What explains these views? I argue that this all goes back to the very definition of the Pakistani state in terms of how it has defined itself and what it considers its identity. So Pakistan, going back to 1947, when it was founded, when it gained independence from, when the Indian Pakistani subcontinent basically gained independence from Britain, and then when Pakistan separated from India, both events occurred at exactly the same time on the stroke of midnight on August 14th, 1947. Pakistan was created as a country for the Muslims of the subcontinent, but very quickly came to define itself as an Islamic state. Those are not the same thing. So it was not necessary that a country that was defined, that was created for the Muslims of the subcontinent would go on to define itself as an Islamic state, but it did, and we can go into the reasons why. And then it also defined itself in terms of the existential threat that it felt from India. And I go again into the reasons why it did that. But you know, one of the reasons was that Pakistan and India were part of the same sort of subcontinent. And for centuries, Hindus and Muslims had lived together in harmony. And then when Pakistan separated from India upon independence from Britain, it had to define itself differently from the country that it had separated from. So it defined itself in terms of Islam, and it defined itself as being fundamentally opposed to and fundamentally under threat from India. Those two pillars of the Pakistani state basically set in motion the events that followed and the decisions the Pakistani state undertook from then onwards. It defined Pakistan's politics. It defined the ascendance of its military. Its military became the most important institution in the country, because if a country feels like it has to constantly defend itself, right, that's its fundamental pillar, that it has to defend itself from its neighbor, who it considers its enemy. The military becomes, by definition, the most important institution in the country, the strongest institution in the country. So its military became the most, the most important player in the state. So the state is defined, you know, the state is the military, it's politicians more, but it became a fundamental element of its state. The its Islamist parties, despite the fact that they would never do well electorally, became very important in terms of helping set kind of political narratives, in terms of later affecting its curriculum, in terms of putting pressure to have Pakistan's laws defined a certain way. And then it also affected the decisions it took. So, if one looks at sort of the arc of history, one of the decisions Pakistan took that really fundamentally affected its trajectory was to sign on to the Soviet-Afghan jihad in the 1980s, with the help of U.S. Money and arms, and with the help of Saudi Arabian money. Pakistan helped train the Mujahideen that fought the Soviets in Afghanistan. It trained these Mujahideen in the concept of jihad, holy war. That concept of jihad became very fundamental to the country. And that is a concept, and those sort of militants that were created as part of that concept, then once the US Soviet Afghan jihad ended in the at the end of the 1980s, those Mujahideen, you know, many of them returned to Pakistan. Pakistan then, the Pakistani state turned them eastward toward India to help fight the to sort of help arm Kashmiri insurgents in fighting against India. So they turned eastward. Why did Pakistan rely on these sort of militant proxies? Because it could not win the conventional wars it fought against India. Because it could not win those conventional wars, it had to rely on sort of non-state militants. That is also why Pakistan invested in its nuclear program, because it could not win the conventional wars it fought against India in 1965, 1971. So many of these kind of strategic decisions the Pakistani state took were, again, because of this sort of master narrative it had of itself as being under threat from India and being an Islamic state that had to defend itself. Other elements of this helps sort of set the kind of the macro creation of terrorist groups, etc., in motion. Then in sort of the post 2001 time frame, when the US war on terror in Afghanistan began, Pakistan signed on to that war on terror, and helped, you know, allied with the US in that war on terror. Then many of the same Mujahideen who had fought the Soviets in Afghanistan and who sort of had returned to Pakistan's tribal areas then turned against the Pakistani state for fighting the war on terror, for allying with the US on the war on terror. And that was the creation of the Pakistan Taliban, or the TTP, that founded itself as an umbrella organization. TTP stands for the Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan. It's an umbrella organization of Taliban groups. That undertook most of the bombings between 2007 and 2014. And Pakistan's narrative on this group was really, really troubling. The Pakistani state initially, like in the sort of the mid 2000s, when the group had started to constitute itself and started to undertake sort of low level insurgency against the Pakistani state, elements in the Pakistani state said, you know, these are our brothers, they can be contained. And for many years they tried to engage in peace talks with them. And it was only in 2014, especially in December 2014, when there was an attack on the Army Public School in Peshawar, which killed more than 130 school children, that the government and the military and the Pakistani people sort of really turned against the Pakistan Taliban, even in terms of narratives, and realized, look, you know, we need to take action against this group. And so the military ramped up its military offensive against the group. It's called Zarb-e-Azb. It was called Zarb-e-Azb. And that basically succeeded in dismantling the Pakistan Taliban, getting rid of many of its members, pushing some of them into Afghan territory. But attacks since 2015 have abated in Pakistan quite a bit in terms of violence. However, there are certain militant groups that remain active in Pakistan, and those are the groups that target, you know, the Kashmiri jihadists, the groups that are the Kashmiri jihadists that target India, and that consider fighting for the Kashmir cause their mission. So that's the Lashkar-e-Taiba and the Jaish-e-Mohammed, which have been in the news lately, and then elements of the Afghan Taliban in Balochistan, and we can talk about why that is the case. I want to go on to talking a little bit about Pakistan's. Let's see how I'm doing on time. Okay. Pakistan's laws, the education system, because those are sort of fundamental elements of my book. On laws, I'll just say very briefly that Pakistan Islamized itself starting from 1947, But it only undertook a very sort of regressive Islamization after 1971. And one of the reasons was the secession of Bangladesh, that used to be East Pakistan, from Pakistan. When that happened, Pakistan doubled down on its definition of itself as an Islamic state. Again, that faced a fundamental threat from India. because it considered India as having helped Bangladesh secede. And at that point, one of the things that happened is that Pakistan's laws started getting Islamized to a much greater degree. And if one has to point to one sort of period that was sort of the darkest in Pakistan's history, that was the 1980s, when the military dictator Zia-ul Haq, who was in power from 1977 to 1988, who took power in a military coup, hanged the prime minister that he had ousted, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. Zia-ul Haq had been the chief of army staff for Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. He took power in a military coup in 1977, hanged Bhutto in 1979. And then until he died in a plane crash in mysterious circumstances in 1988, he was the leader of the country, and he put in place sort of some of the laws that, again, you may have heard of, the blasphemy laws in particular. Those had existed in a format since the time of the British, since 1860. But the blasphemy, sort of the amendments that he put in place for the blasphemy laws were key in 1984 and 1986 respectively. These were that he made offenses against the Quran, the holy book of Muslims, and offenses against the Prophet Muhammad punishable by imprisonment for life and by death respectively. And the wording that he used, and I have the wording detailed in a chapter of my book, and I talk about this quite a bit. The wording that that was put in place for the blasphemy laws was so opaque that anything basically could be considered blasphemy if the person considered it offensive. So if I say that something that I've heard might be offensive to the Prophet, I can accuse that the person that I heard it from of blasphemy. And at that point, that person could be punishable by death, right, according to this law. And this law had an effect. So before 1985, there were literally less than a few accusations of blasphemy in Pakistan. After 1985, there have been more than 1,300 accusations of blasphemy in Pakistan. There has been vigilante violence against those accused of blasphemy. There have been false accusations of blasphemy. You know, most recently there was a case that people may have heard of Asia Bibi, a Christian woman who was on death row for blasphemy since 2010, who was recently freed, but it freed by the Supreme Court, acquitted, but it resulted in huge protests in the country, and so we can talk about that. Many Pakistanis have internalized the blasphemy law as being as being sort of fundamental to Pakistan. So 75, if you survey Pakistanis, you know, the majority of them, 75% in the case of a survey that I shared here, 75% of them said that we believe the blasphemy laws are necessary to protect Islam in Pakistan. So laws like this have engendered a sense of intolerance, right? And again, one can trace them to the institute, that sort of sense of intolerance, to the institution of the law. It's not that Pakistanis, you know, came into this world intolerant, right? You can actually go back and trace it to the law becoming a fundamental part of the legal system in Pakistan. So a couple of final comments. I think a very substantial part of my book talks about how the education system has helped engender some of the attitudes that I sort of talked about at the beginning. In fact, my book started out by looking, or my research on this book started out by looking at the relationship between education and extremism.